and welcome. I'm Dr. Mona Kular, and this is To Immunity and Beyond. I'm a medically trained doctor and nutrition and health coach, and I love helping people find the very best version of themselves. This show is all about living well, feeling well, and most importantly, aging well. The immune system is essentially the body's wellness system, so by understanding and supporting it, we can all reach an optimal level of health. I'll be having conversations with a wide range of experts from around the world on all the areas that can support our immune system to help us live healthier for longer. Let's live life better. Hi, and welcome to Immunity and Beyond. Today I'm joined by Dr. Vinita Patel. Vinita is a paediatrician and a nutritional therapist, and she sees children and their families both in the NHS and privately in her own practice. We're going to be talking about how the immune system develops right the way from pregnancy through childhood and into adulthood. This is a really interesting conversation, not only for parents, but for anyone who wants to know more about how their own immunity may have developed over time and the sorts of things they can do to influence it.
Hello, Vinita. It's so nice to see you again today. Thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Vinita, we first met actually 5 or 6 years ago at a functional medicine event and got chatting over all things lifestyle, nutrition and health related. Your background, though, is as a paediatrician, which is a children's medicine doctor. Mm-hmm. Could we start by just finding out how you made the journey from that into more nutrition and lifestyle based medicine and how you combine the two now?
Yes, of course. So I think I always had an interest in nutrition, particularly even through medical school, despite not having any training in it. I think it came from when I was growing up because we had sort of influences around Ayurveda. And so it was always there in the background. And then when I started my journey into pediatrics, I realized that there isn't really a training for nutrition. So I went into community pediatrics. And I think that attracted me because it was a really holistic approach to a child. You get to spend an hour with the child and family. You really understand the whole dynamics around the child. It's not just focusing on one aspect of a child. And that really did appeal to me. And then I had my own children. And when my second child was about the age of one, he became unwell. And we decided to address it with nutrition, with Ayurveda. And it really transformed his health. So that, I think, really sparked an interest for me to do my own training. And a friend of mine had been studying at the College of Naturopathic Medicine. So she showed me her notes. She's also a doctor. And she said, oh, why don't you have a look? And it was explaining how broccoli has all these compounds in it and how they interact with things in your body. And I was like, this is amazing. There's actual science behind it. So within months, I was signed up for the following year to start. And that was a part-time nutritional therapy course, but it was a naturopathic approach. So it did incorporate things like Ayurveda, Chinese medicine, which is why it spoke to me much more as well. And so I finished that and I decided to just start work as a nutritional therapist. So I did actually start seeing adults because the training is geared towards adults. And then slowly I sort of realized I wanted to bring my own interest of pediatrics in, and that evolved over the course of the years. But I also went back into community pediatrics in the NHS, partly because they were looking for someone with an interest in nutrition. There was a service which was for children with a high BMI, so they were looking for a pediatrician who could support that service. And so those married my interests very well. So I've been doing that since about 2015. As well as running neurodevelopmental clinics. And alongside, I've carried on my private practice, which is now honed to just being children's nutritional therapy, which is the same as functional medicine, essentially. So yes, that's my journey.
I love that. You've actually really managed to cultivate all your interests and bring them together beautifully, haven't you, into being able to do all the things you enjoy and that you're passionate about. And there are two things you said there that really struck me, actually. The first thing that, you know, when your son was unwell and you looked into a different way, perhaps, of approaching it than traditional medicine might do. And yeah, that really sparked your interest and then perhaps your journey into nutritional medicine. Do you think it's the case that that happens with a lot of people, that they almost need to have their own either personal sort of turning point or something in someone close to them that really makes them stop and look at things slightly differently and then can almost push them in a slightly different direction and open horizons for them?
I do. I think every nutritional therapist that I've spoken to has had either their own health journey, which has led them to wanting to study, or as you said, in a close family member or friend. But I mean, obviously there are people who are just generally interested, but what leads people into specializing usually is in something that they've experienced. And actually I find that more powerful, because you can say, I've been on that journey myself, and I'm going to hold your hand through that journey as well.
I think you're right. And the word powerful there actually is key, isn't it? Because it holds so much meaning when you've been somewhere yourself, you've been through that journey, and you can really identify with it and connect with it, and then do that with your clients or patients as well. And the other thing you said, which resonated with me, was when you mentioned broccoli. I love broccoli, by the way. But the first time as medics or as traditionally trained doctors that we come across this information about food, that actually there's so much more to it than just stuff you put in your mouth to keep you going through the day. It's quite eye-opening, isn't it? It's actually quite incredible when you find out there are all these compounds and chemicals and nutrients and minerals and all these things in food that actually do things within your body that keep you physiologically healthy and can really support sort of your health.
I know, it's a wonder how nature has designed these things for us. And I keep finding it wonderful every time I learn a new piece of information.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about children's health and immunity as well, because that's important in children's health and in their future health. Can we talk about the immune system and how it first develops in children and the important factors that set children up to have good immunity or perhaps may compromise how their immunity is first set up?
Yeah. So we have this period which has been coined the term the first 1,000 days. So this is really from the point of conception to around the age of 2 years. And we know that there are so many changes which occur during that time, which set your health for actually the rest of your life. So it's not just childhood health, which is influenced by this phase of development. Obviously, during pregnancy, the maternal health is key to how the fetus is not only developing, but also acquiring immunity, because your antibodies are talking to the child and the child is taking on those antibodies. And things like neutrophils are actually produced quite early on, surprisingly. And then in the last trimester, there's a real expansion of the immune system. And so when babies are born at full term, they are essentially ready for exposure to the world, if you like. And then there is this aspect of what happens at birth. So we know that the way that you're born actually does carry a lot of influence for your immune system. And going back to where your immune system is housed, so we know that it's mostly, primarily, it is in the gut. And we used to think that babies were born with a sterile gut with no bacteria, but we now realize that there are bacteria which are coming from the amniotic fluid mostly, and that the process of birth is then when you acquire most of your bacteria for the first few months of life. So the process of coming through the vaginal canal is when you take that big sniff or swallow of these bacteria, which then go on to colonize your large bowel. And we could get a bit technical here. So around the time of birth, there's a lot of pressure and it's natural for some feces to come out. And actually, people are now understanding that there is a reason for that, because you then have a bit more of a colonization if the baby comes through that. And so before, people used to take a suppository or try and clear their bowel. So that we're not encouraging anymore, because we're realizing that this process is so important for just the initial colonization. And then the next process is if you are able to breastfeed. And that's again when your bacteria are being fed, because in breast milk we have these oligosaccharides, which are essentially the food for bacteria. So they're not feeding the baby. It tastes sweet, but actually that sweetness is not necessarily for the baby, it's for those bacteria. And I think we're still understanding the magic of what is in breast milk. It's this potent soup of bacteria and things which promote the health of the gut, promote the health of the immune system. And it's also where the baby's getting their first exposure to the world in terms of immunity. So that process for the first few months is the initial kind of stage of development of the immune system. And then you're introducing things like solid food. So that's when you're getting your next main change in terms of your gut bacteria. So we've got a real switch from when they're born, when they hardly have any bacteria, to 6 months when you're introducing things which are going to really change the profile of bacteria. Now, all of that is in an ideal world, but we know that this doesn't always happen, does it? And you know from your work that you meet parents and they've had to have interventions in pregnancy, after pregnancy, and it's all to just keep the baby alive and keep the mum healthy, and that's all fine.
Glad you've mentioned that, actually, because I was going to say there'll be people listening who might be concerned that for whatever reason they weren't able to have a natural vaginal delivery, or that they weren't able to breastfeed. So I'm hoping you're going to tell us about things that they can still do to support their baby's health.
So we know that if you missed out on some of those periods, there are definitely brilliant ways to help replenish those bacteria. So one of those is by, when you're introducing solid foods, you give that wide range of vegetable fibres. So you're not just giving one vegetable for days on end, you're really giving a variety and rotating through that for at least the first few months. And it's not about the quantity, it's more about the variety. So even weaning information has changed, because we know that that does prime again your immunity and also your gut bacteria. And then there's the controversial area of probiotics. I don't know if you get lots of questions about probiotics.
I definitely do. And there seems to be so much conflicting advice and even evidence actually on this, and things sort of seem to change quite regularly. So I'd love to know what your sort of thoughts and advice that you give your patients are on probiotics.
Yeah, so we know that there are probiotic supplements. So these are the sort of things that come in sachets or as powders for children, for babies, that you would mix into foods. And those do have a base. So there is some evidence around using them, particularly if they've either had to give antibiotics to a baby, then giving some probiotics afterwards, we know that helps the replenishment. But also if they've possibly had an intervention at birth, not been able to breastfeed, then there may be a place for giving those infant probiotics. But the issue of probiotics is they're bacteria which don't really last. So they come into the body and essentially their function really only lasts for around 24 hours from all the studies that we've got to date. Now, there is some evidence that even bits of bacteria left are going to help start those populations growing. So it's definitely worth giving them. But the more important factor is actually to feed bacteria. So we're talking about prebiotics. And I think we're now understanding that they're probably more important to think about. Now, prebiotics are going to come in through milk, so that there are fibers and undigestible things which feed bacteria in milk, but mostly through foods. So that's, again, why we focus on this weaning period.
Thank you for going through that. I'm just going to recap that quickly for people listening. So the immune system, most of which, around 70%, is housed in and around the gut and is heavily influenced and trained by the bacteria that live in our gut, is developing right the way from when babies are growing within their mother, but then especially when they're first delivered and they first come into contact with all these bacteria that start to then take up residence in their gut, essentially. And so if they have been delivered naturally and then are breastfed, those things really support and nourish that. But for women who haven't been able to do those things, there are other things they can do, like when they start weaning them, make sure they introduce them to a really wide variety of different types of plant-based foods, and also potentially look at some of these probiotics, but also prebiotics, which are now starting to, their importance is now being much more understood.
That's right.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk. for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
The station that makes you feel good.
So we have an innate immunity that we're essentially we're born with that. So it's our first defense. It's non-specific. So it's a defense against pretty much everything. And that is something you're born with, but there is some immaturity at birth. So very small babies can still be more prone to getting infections, as we know. So we are very careful with them. But what we want to do is try and expose them gradually as they get a bit older. So after around the age of 2 months, we do want them to kind of be exposed to environmental things. So there is evidence around if you have something like a pet or if you are going outdoors, not to be too worried about hygiene and bacteria in terms of things like mud. So that kind of hygiene hypothesis, which has come in and out of fashion, is still there in terms of the innate and adaptive immunity. So adaptive immunity is when we make antibodies to something. So we've been exposed to, say, a virus or a bacteria, and we're making antibodies. And that's something that develops through most of childhood, through life, if you like. But those early days, we're still more prone to those things.
And that's an important point that you've raised, it, the hygiene hypothesis. Yeah. We do need some exposure to all kinds of bacteria and viruses so that our immune system can see them and recognise them and remember them for future reference and just build a more robust defence system for us. So actually, it is important, especially in those early days, to let children explore a bit more without constantly, you know, antibacterializing everything and sanitizing everything. And as you say, even in the garden, you know, there are microbes in mud, aren't there, and soil that actually can be really beneficial for the immune system. So a little bit of dirt isn't such a bad thing. And just being outdoors is great in itself. And you mentioned the pets too. I think with pets, is it that they have their own microbiome as well? And some of that then is sort of, you know, transferred to us and vice versa. So there's that kind of beneficial effect there.
Yeah. So we know that families generally, that microbiomes adapt together. So they generally have a similar microbiome after about the age of 3 for a child. It kind of mimics usually what the other family members have in the microbiome, which is an interesting way of thinking about it.
Yeah. So for people listening who are thinking, either as parents or as individuals, thinking, oh gosh, well, my first 2 years weren't, you know, as they should have been potentially according to this ideal, or parents worrying that they haven't done the best for their children, because, you know, a lot of this is newer as well, isn't it? We didn't necessarily know about the gut microbiome in as much detail as we do now and its importance and relevance. Can we override, or what can we do to sort of build upon, say, if our first 2 years weren't as ideal as we'd have liked them to be?
Yeah, so there's definitely room to maneuver in terms of the microbiome. And as we talked about, when you're thinking about replenishing and growing populations, you're also thinking about the diversity of those populations. So we might need to introduce some probiotic supplements or probiotic foods. So as you get older, children tend not to like those really strong flavours, but some do eat their sauerkrauts and kimchis and things.
And actually in other countries, lots of children, like, yeah, do, in Korea, children grow up eating kimchi as an ordinary thing, don't they? So is there something to be said for trying to introduce those early if you can, do you think? Or
I think so. So if you have that opportunity, every taste should be introduced as early as possible for other reasons as well, which is, yeah, about taste preference. But I think that we all have a traditional sort of fermented food in our diets. Every culture has a culture, if you like.
Yeah,
so use that one, which is more familiar to you, might be more familiar taste. And then as people get older, they're much more likely to embrace newer foods. So then you can introduce a wider range of probiotic foods. And as they do have strong flavor, it might take you a while to get used to it, but do that as much as possible. Be open to those new things. So we're talking about all the K's, the kimchi, the kraut, the kefir, the kombucha, a little bit of kombucha if it's bought, but you could try making some kombucha. Don't forget things like yogurt, which are also full of good bacteria. And we have other fermented foods. So in Indian households, we have things like fermented dosa, which is rice and lentil pancakes. You know, everyone has their own little recipe for a fermented food.
They do. And actually, I've noticed, and I'm sure you have, that as these things have become more known about, it's easier to get hold of things in supermarkets now, isn't it? You can buy kefir, kimchi, sauerkraut, you can get yogurts with kefir, you can get kombucha, either ready-made or as a cordial. So it's much easier now to incorporate these into your day-to-day life.
Exactly. And then also not forgetting your prebiotic food.
I was about to ask you more about those.
Yeah, so there are fantastic vegetables which are very rich in prebiotics. And there's sort of whole families at the moment. Asparagus is in season. That's a great prebiotic food. But actually, just thinking again about variety, we talk about having 30 different plants in a week. Not always practical for people, but if you can aspire to that, don't forget that includes things like herbs and spices. So it's not so difficult to get to if you include some of those.
And you can include nuts and whole grains in that as well, and seeds, can't you? So if you have a wide variety.
Yeah, all the things which have a kind of a skin. So all the legumes, all the lentils, all the beans, that skin is essentially what's undigested by us and a great food for those bacteria. And then some people will need to take a supplement. But what I always say is actually try and get a trained professional to go through your history and see what would be a good place or type of supplement to introduce, rather than thinking about just going off and having a random supplement. Generally, there's no harm in taking probiotic supplements, but there is one caveat, which is that they can cause excess gas in some people. So you can actually get symptoms. Some people can be very unwell if their bacteria are producing something like histamine, which is a chemical that can make you feel quite unwell. So rather than going blindly, it's better to go and see someone such as a functional medicine specialist or nutritional therapist.
Yeah, we really need to be looking at supporting and nurturing the diversity. So that's all the different types of bacteria in the gut, because the more different types we have, the better for us and for our immune system. And the best way to do this is by the foods that we're eating, you know, having as diverse a range of plant-based fibers, because that's what they like to eat, as possible. So they're going to come from our prebiotic foods that we've mentioned, and the probiotics, which have actually got the bacteria in them themselves. Now, are there things that we end up doing with or without realizing that can disrupt or be harmful towards our gut microbiome, so towards the bacteria in there, and sort of shift away from that diversity?
Yes. Yeah, so, well, there are things that we do as doctors which can cause an issue. So sometimes we feel we need to prescribe antibiotics, which obviously are going to be very beneficial in terms of reducing or getting rid of a bacteria. But the side effect is that it also may have reduced or got rid of some good bacteria. And so although it may be necessary, it's really important after you finish them to take a probiotic. And again, you can ask which one would be suitable for yourself. And there are some which have now been designed for taking with antibiotics. So that's one aspect. The other is in terms of lifestyle. So there are things we can do which might disrupt our gut permeability and also disrupt some populations of gut bacteria. Things like having a lot of stress in our life is actually one of them. we don't necessarily think about stress in children, but I think the pandemic has really highlighted how stress can come out as a symptom, an illness, or just how their immune system is responding. And so I've heard a lot of stories of that happening. And so it's a case of we have to help children with how to deal with stress, but also help to rebuild the issue, such as the immune system.
With stress, I think children actually very much pick up on the stress of the individuals around them as well, don't they? So they might not have direct stressors on them, but if their parents are stressed or the environment at home is highly stressed, you know, and the pandemic has put stress on a lot of people, children do sense that. And so that does also cause stress to them.
Yeah. And they're also watching how we respond to stress as a parent. So we're essentially modelling how to respond to situations, how we can reduce our own stress. Most of what they pick up is actually watching us rather than what we tell them, as I'm sure you know.
We try our best, don't we? It doesn't always go to plan.
And then there are some dietary things. So if you did, for whatever reason, not have a balanced diet in terms of having a good amount of healthy carbohydrates, proteins, vegetables, fruits, then we know that if you do that for a long time, so if you have many meals which are perhaps fast food or highly refined, then that will have an impact on the gut. Yeah, so we know that the things which are healthy in general for us are also healthy for the gut microbiome, and the reverse is true. So the things which cause us to feel unwell and not do our best in terms of eating, exercising, sleeping, all of those things will have an impact on our gut microbiome.
And something you've just mentioned that I'm sure a lot of parents who are listening will suddenly be thinking, oh, how do I do this? Children and, you know, a diverse diet full of healthy things like vegetables and fruits and nuts and grains and all, you know, complex carbohydrates and lots of fiber.
Yes.
With the best will in the world, it can be difficult. And especially if it's something that hasn't been introduced from the very beginning, if tastes and palates have developed in a certain way. What advice do you normally give to parents if they're struggling, say, with their children being stuck in a rut of only wanting particular types of foods that perhaps aren't as good for them as they could be? So if they're highly processed, or they only like chicken nuggets, or they just want to have, you know, chips every day. Yeah. Are there little steps that parents can take to sort of start that journey towards including more diversity?
Definitely. So fussy eating, there are definite stages where that happens kind of naturally, particularly toddlers. But we know that that can persist, that can continue, or it can come in later on, sometimes in response to stresses. And essentially, it's children choosing something that they feel is a safe food. It's often a beige food. It's not, you know, any coloured vegetables. Mm-hmm. It's often foods which don't have any bitterness, again, and it's something that they can predict is always going to be the same. So with that in mind, you don't want to make huge changes because they really aren't going to accept it. So you want to use the flavours, the textures and the taste that they actually like, and very gradually introduce things which are similar. So it might be, if they love rice, just grate a little bit of cauliflower into the rice, something like that. So we want to introduce it in a way by stealth. So you might blend other vegetables into a tomato sauce that they're happy to have. But then you also do want to give them that exposure to the vegetables and fruits and other things. So you want them to see the whole ones, and actually it's best done by sitting together and you're eating them. You've got them in front of them on the plate. They're being exposed in terms of smells, colour, looking at them. If they allow it, put it on their plate. If they feel like it, they may just have a taste. And it's a very gradual process, but it does work. It can be so difficult and frustrating, but it is possible, definitely.
No, and I think that's really useful, because what you're doing then is you're modelling that behaviour for your children, aren't you? And whilst you're not enforcing it, you're showing them how you can eat and the different types of things. And as you say, then gradually they'll start to perhaps pick something off your plate to try it. I know that when I do tend to eat a very colourful, you know, diverse diet, and my children perhaps isn't quite the same as mine, but they always see what I'm eating, and quite often they will pick something off my plate just to try it. And for me, that's good enough, because then sometimes they think, oh, actually, that's quite nice, can I have that next time? Sometimes they're not, and that's fine too. But I also love what you said about equally sneaking things in here and there. And actually, pasta sauces, for example, is a great way you can cook some vegetables, blend them up into a tomato sauce, and they'll never know they're in there. And soups, I do a lot of soups where I do an end of week soup and I just get everything green from the fridge, stick it in. But my kids love peas, for example. So they don't know there's also leeks in there. There's some spinach, there's, you know, onion, there's garlic, there's all these other things. And they've just, you know, they've just gone in. So what do you think are the main, you know, what are the main issues that you see in clinic when it comes to immunity and infections and lifestyle? Are there any things we're seeing more of these days that we didn't used to, or less of perhaps even?
I think there are two things. So firstly, yes, I do see children who have a lot of infections. They just constantly seem to be either with a temperature or runny nose all the time, chronic cough, things like that. So that's more to do with their immune system. And we also then see children who are what we call atopic. So That's that kind of trio of asthma, eczema, hay fever, but also allergies. So those are the things which seem to be increasing. I know that if I compare to when I first started training in pediatrics, we barely spoke about peanut allergy. And now it's everywhere, you know, every school has to be nut free. And so we know that this allergy is like an epidemic, if you like. Yes. So we're definitely seeing more of all of those in clinic.
And what are we linking that to then? Is that due to something that we've changed, the way our lifestyles change, the way our diets change, something we're exposed to more? Because you're right, it's something that our parents certainly didn't worry about. You know, you didn't have to think twice about sending your child into school with something nut-based in their snack box or lunch box. Whereas now, actually, you know, it sort of instills fear in all of us, doesn't it? How has that changed so dramatically?
Well, we know that it's probably a combination of all these factors. Firstly, there is a genetic link for atopy, particularly for things like asthma, eczema, hay fever. So we often hear, oh, the parents had it, even their parents may have had it. So there's that genetic factor, but we know that that's not the whole story. And another part of the story is environment, it's lifestyle. And we see that there is predominance in more urban environment. So that is probably one of the areas that we should be thinking about a lot more now. What is the environment of where not only the child is living in terms of the home, but what's outside of the home, and these environmental pollutants that we're really only beginning to understand how they affect the body. People call it the exposome. So it's what your body's exposed to in terms of the world. And it's only quite recent that that has become really industrial. And our bodies, we know that we do adapt to environments, but we don't adapt that quickly. So this change in how we live has come quite in the last, 30, 40 years, and our bodies are going to take another 50, 60, 100 years to adapt to it. In the meantime, we're being exposed to metals, we're being exposed to pollutants, and we're seeing that directly in children who live in urban environments with their asthma. So paediatricians are seeing that all the time. But there's also a more subtle thing. So we're seeing, oh, there's just a bit more eczema around. Is that also linked? And things like homes where there's maybe molds that have been there for a long time, that's again sometimes this underlying factor. So they're not direct triggers, but they can be underlying. So this combination of genetics, environment, and then we have to talk about nutrition as well. So our food, I mean, it's changed a lot since, you know,
it has, hasn't it?
It's time.
Well, we have so much more food that is more, it is more processed. We live busier lives, so even as parents, we can struggle to always make fresh food from scratch. Sometimes we don't even know particularly how to do that or what things are best to eat. And we know that, you know, a lot of those foods are more inflammatory. We have more omega-6 in our diets and not enough omega-3. And as you say, you know, decreases the diversity of the gut microbiome, which affects our immunity. So diet's a big one really as well, isn't it?
For children, I think, you know, they definitely are getting less exposure in terms of getting sunlight. So even in the summer months, they are vitamin D deficient. Yeah. They're definitely nowhere near eating the amount of fish that people did in the past or getting omega-3 in other ways. So those are two which are so closely linked to your immune system and to all of these allergic type responses.
Is there a place for supplementation in children in terms of omega-3 and probiotics? We've obviously talked about already, but what about omega-3, for example?
So omega-3, I would say most children aren't eating 3 portions of oily fish plus or minus the other omega-3 rich foods. And so most would benefit from supplementation. Again, it is difficult to just tell you randomly to take an omega-3 because there's such a difference in the quality between one supplement and another. So that's when I would say, again, ask a professional or even in a health shop where they are trained in supplements, ask in there and get a good quality supplement. Yes, it is more expensive, but if you're going to give a supplement, then it is far better to give a good quality one because oils can go off. And omega-3 is an oil. So it could be at any stage of the process of making that omega-3 that there's been an opportunity for it to spoil. And then you're doing the opposite. You're not helping your system.
And what about vitamin supplements in general? There's obviously a huge market. Yeah. I mean, the vitamin supplement market's huge anyway, but there's a big market for children, isn't there? Should parents be thinking about that if their children eat relatively well, or do you think it's only something to consider if they don't, or do they need them at all?
Vitamin D is one that I would say, you know, the NHS says we all should be taking a supplement. It's free for under fives to have a lot of vitamins anyway. So that's kind of a no-brainer. And also it doesn't matter which type of vitamin D. If you can get D3, that's better. But pretty much all children should take vitamin D in this country. When it comes to the other nutrients, mostly if you have a good balanced diet, you could get enough through diet. So if a child isn't healthy for whatever reason, then I would think more carefully about giving a multi-nutrient. But again, they're so different, aren't they? And yeah. You know, for children, it's about the taste. So some of them
absolutely. It has to be the chewy strawberry one, or they're not having it at all.
Exactly. So that's slightly part of the problem, because sometimes the better tasting ones don't necessarily have the most easily absorbed vitamin or mineral in them. So it's better to ask advice. But if you have a child who isn't a great eater, then giving a good quality multi doesn't do any harm, essentially. And usually it contains vitamin D. So you're just giving everything in one. And if I'm in my NHS clinic where we can't give sort of detailed nutrition advice, that's what I would say. I would say go to a very good pharmacy or health shop and ask them for a good quality multi-nutrient for your child. It might be a bit of trial and error because they might not like the taste of one of them. Which is the commonest thing that I hear.
I was going to say, I think that's the main issue parents face with those. I think that's really useful actually for people listening. So it can be confusing, can't it, as a parent to know whether it's worth doing that or not.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip, because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Something you touched on very briefly earlier that I'd like to ask you a bit more about is sleep, because we know that sleep is also critical for the microbiome and for a million other things in general. I often come across situations where children aren't getting as much sleep as they should be.
Yeah.
Is this something you see often, and how do you approach that? Because it can be quite difficult when parents don't understand how much sleep their children actually need.
So we were talking about this yesterday, that actually we're, as paediatricians, we're understanding that sleep is such an important aspect of a child's health. And before we received very little training on it, but now we are beginning to know what are the sort of fundamentals around helping a child to have a good quality sleep and the sort of good number of hours of sleep. Now, mostly parents do want their child to go to bed at a reasonable hour. And I think it's when they're older that sort of becomes a bit more relaxed. And obviously there's this pushback from children who don't want to go to bed because there's far more exciting things to do. So I think it's around creating that hygiene, that hour or two before bed, which is your wind down, where you're hopefully away from screens. I know it's difficult when the children are older and needing to do homework. I've got my own kids who've had that. So perhaps some blue blocking glasses where you're not getting the blue light, which is stimulating them before bed, and just helping them to then wind down, whether it's them reading on their own, listening to something, perhaps a bath We all love Epsom salts in the bath, which helps with that production of things like GABA, which is your relaxation hormone, and doing things which are going to also help your melatonin. So melatonin is actually a hormone we make when we're going off to sleep. But it's also a hormone which is like an anti-aging, anti-inflammatory, it interacts with your immune system. So it has many other things which it needs to do while you're sleeping. So we used to think it just kind of helped you go off, but it has many more roles. And so we know that if you're not necessarily making as much, your immune system may not be functioning at its best. Yes, at night, where our bacteria are replenishing. So that's the other time where we're sort of repairing, replenishing everything. I think when you explain to parents in that sense is that at night, your child is making growth hormone. That's when they're going to grow. That's when their immune system is being supported, then they really understand, okay, we need to focus and work out how to keep the room dark, keep the environment quiet, have that nice wind down time, and just allow a child to have that deep sleep. And just, you know, think about any factors which are going to interfere with that. It's often easier said than done, but that you can definitely go some way to improving the sleep.
Definitely. And I think it's really interesting that you've said that as paediatricians, you're now getting or have been getting more information and are encouraged to, you know, get that message out there more, because sleep has been something that's been overlooked for quite a long time, I think. And as you say, now that we understand more about the role that the hormones play, like melatonin, but also the impact that sleep or lack of sleep has on our hormones, including our appetite hormones, in fact, and you know, various other things, just to try and really encourage that. And the other thing, I suppose, is to have a regular routine, isn't it? So to try and have a regular bedtime, because that reinforces the body clock and makes it easier for that melatonin level to start kicking in at around the right time so that sleep can be achieved more easily.
That's right. And also making sure that you're including some physical activity earlier in the day.
Yeah.
So not trampolining late into the night, but if they come home from school, that's the ideal opportunity to do some physical activity, which again contributes to having a deep and restful sleep.
And exercise, again, is important for the immune system as well. Yeah. And another thing that we are perhaps facing is children not being as physically active as they used to be. Again, as society's changed, and children probably spend a little bit less time outdoors just playing because they're more attracted to their devices or the television, or it's so much easier to not do anything. Is this again something you come across, and how do you bring that up with parents?
We definitely see children as being less active, far less outdoors, and there are less incentives for them to be outdoors. Again, if we talk about the urban environment, it's to do with access to these spaces. And so if at least there might be an opportunity, if you pick up a child from school, there might be an opportunity on the way home to go to a park. So we do encourage that for all of our patients in the NHS. If you have other access to going further out into the countryside at weekends, obviously that's amazing. Doing things as a family. So having those as part of your routine, that, you know, as a family, we're all going to go off to do this walk at a weekend. I think, again, in the COVID pandemic, people have been doing that a lot more, which has been lovely to see. Use of any areas which are green around them, and the whole balance of being on a screen and gaming against being outdoors. So just having some boundaries around what is done with the screen at what time. We know that also impacts sleep as well. So
definitely. And I think as parents, just being aware of that's really important. And it's so easy as a parent, and I'm sure you've found this too, that when you're busy, you sort of leave the children to it. And after a while, you think, gosh, they've just been sitting there for ages whilst I've been running around doing X, Y, and Z. And actually, it's remembering to go and say to them, right, you've had enough time watching telly or on your iPad now. Why don't you just go outside and, you know, give them something to do, even maybe get them to tidy up a bit of the garden or sweep the patio or just anything, just to get them outside. And usually with children, what you do find is once they're outside, they love it. It's just getting them out there in the first place. And once they're there, they then, you know, they have so much ingenuity. They'll come up with all kinds of things to start doing, usually creating more mess to clear up later. But that's not, doesn't matter, does it, if they're outside and having fun and just being active?
So it's also about that exposure to things like mud and the environmental, whatever the trees and the plants are exuding, is also part of our sort of medicine, if you like. So I think we need to just remind ourselves of that.
Yeah. And in fact, I had a really interesting conversation with Dr. Jenna Macciocci, an immunologist, and yes, we were talking about nature, and she was saying that, you know, leaves and plants actually exude chemicals that directly impact on cells within the immune system. So there's a really direct connection there. You know, so spending time outdoors when and if you can is actually really beneficial.
Yeah, another free medicine like sleep and exercise.
They're all there to be accessed, aren't they? It's just remembering that they're there, remembering how effective they can be, and then sort of putting those practices in place to try and access them more and more regularly and consistently as well.
Yeah, priority, I think.
I think we've done a really nice overview of how that immune system develops right from pregnancy all the way through sort of toddlerhood and then even into adulthood, and the things we can do, the things that happen naturally that can support it, and then the things that we can do to further bolster that, and things to avoid as well. What would you say then your overriding tips would be for parents and also for individuals themselves in terms of supporting their own health and lifestyle for good immunity and good health, or that of their children?
So I think I would put stress as number one. So we know that whatever we do in terms of eating and drinking, stress is kind of overriding. And if we have our strategies to reduce our own stress and help our children to move through that stress, that's definite number one for me. And we've seen that over the last year. Number two, I think, would be daily movement outdoors, if you can incorporate that. For children, it's almost something that they need as part of their life. And just remembering that. And if we can do it with them, even better. And then thinking about nutrition. So are we, hopefully, as often as possible, doing home-cooked meals with fresh ingredients as far as we can? And the other thing I love to talk about is getting children involved with that process. Even if they're not necessarily doing a lot of cooking, they can still wash, they can chop, they can be involved in that process. Far more likely to eat the food that you produce if you do that. Okay. And having variety in that week, so you're getting different vegetables and fruits coming in. If you can, seasonal ones. If not, there's always frozen ones. So not worrying about necessarily that you've only had fresh foods, because we know that frozen is equally good. Thinking about, if they like one thing, how can we just add in another thing which tastes similar? So we're just increasing their repertoire as much as possible through that time, and doing it for ourselves and modelling it. So showing them that we're doing it, and really just enjoying food as well. So just remembering to sit together, have that mindful opportunity to eat and just relax and socialize together as a family or with friends. Because again, we've moved away from the family meal, which I think is at the core of good nutrition. It's not always practical day to day, but at least once or twice a week for families. And then activities together. So if you're doing anything like going for a bike ride or physical activity. I just spoke to a mum who does yoga with her child. You know, I thought that was amazing. And or if you like having a dance around the house, doing those sort of things. So it's not just formal exercise and sport. It's also just moving your body and having fun and making it part of life, if you like. And within that, laughter and silliness. So just bringing in joy into your life every day, being a big child with your little child, when they're teenagers, going back to being a little child and just having that de-stressing moment, if you like. And that's all medicine, really, because we know that, again, our immune system responds to things like that. And then as parents, I always just remind parents that you're doing your best. You're doing your best within whatever limits you've got, with whatever other things you have to do. So not beat yourself up about it, just to encourage them that they're looking for things to help their child. They're trying their best, and congratulate yourself on that as well.
That's definitely needed. And again, it's another really important point that I'm glad you've brought in there, because parents have their own stresses, their own difficulties, their own things that they're juggling and trying to keep going. And ultimately, we are all doing our best. And There will be days when it doesn't go to plan. There might be weeks when it doesn't go to plan, but actually it's looking at the overall patterns. And if on the whole, you're trying more often than not to get the food a bit better, to get more activity in, to do more fun things, to get the sleep better, then that's just heading in the positive direction that you need to be.
Definitely. Progress over perfection, we say, don't we?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you, Vanita. I think that's been a lovely conversation about everything to do with immunity from childhood onwards, really.
Yeah, we've covered lots of areas.
We have. Yeah. If people want to find out more about yourself, your work, or even perhaps connect with you, where can they find out more about you?
Yes. So my, I'm on Instagram and Facebook. It's Health Via Nutrition. And you can contact me by email. I'm always happy to respond. And I run a clinic which is in West London called the Children's Wellness Centre, where I do nutritional therapy. So if people did want to arrange an appointment, that's where I would see them. But I'm also doing video and virtual consultations, so you don't have to be in London.
Thank you very much, Anita, and I hope to speak with you soon.
Oh, thank you, Mona. It's been great talking to you today.
Thank you so much for listening today, and I really hope you've enjoyed this conversation. Do follow me on Instagram at thehealthspandoctor for information on the show, as well as recipes and health and nutrition advice. Until next week, let's live life better.